First of all, I'd like to thank everyone, including Petrotherm and others who have brought me here to this fine country. Let me share with you a little bit of my own journey that I've been on. It seems like my wife continues to remind me. She said, "You've been working on geothermal for as long as I can remember you," which is fairly a long time at this point. Our anniversary was yesterday, our 40th wedding anniversary, if you can believe that. And she said, "Well, you work on something for 35 years and you're an overnight success." And but really, this journey has taught me a lot. I started out working as a young engineer and with the Los Alamos Project back in the early 1970s, and migrated back and forth between Los Alamos and MIT for a while. But it hasn't been really until the last year or so where I've begun to fully appreciate the impact of what's been going on in the rest of the world with respect to geothermal development, and in particular what we now call enhanced or engineered geothermal systems. And I've been lucky, and I'll share with you just a little bit of the last few days of this, or last few weeks. I started out a few weeks ago in Cambridge, Cambridge, Massachusetts, that is, and headed out to Iceland at the invitation of the president of Iceland, President Grimson, for the first time I've been to Iceland, if you can imagine that, too, to see the transformation that country has made in the last 50 years, a transformation from a country that's been essentially fully dependent on fossil fuels and imported oil for all of its energy needs to one that uses geothermal quite extensively, as many of you know, providing all of its space heating needs and 20% of all electricity, and hydropower providing the remaining 70 or plus percent. And they are quickly moving away from being dependent in any way on imported fuels for transportation by considering a hydrogen economy that would use geothermal, particularly very hot geothermal, and electrolysis to generate that hydrogen to be not only carbon-free, but fully indigenous and what they consider to be fairly energy secure. And since that time, since my Icelandic trip, I have been to Reno, Nevada, to look at a new geothermal plant there built by Ormat that uses no water at all, totally re-injects all its fluids, uses no water for cooling. I think something that could be quite attractive in a country like Australia, where water is another primary and important commodity. And then back and forth to Washington. And as part of my preparation for what I'm going to face here in the next few days in Australia, I've had an opportunity to speak to the U.S. Congress on four occasions now in the past 4 months, something that I think has never happened before in the history of at least the energy work in the U.S., that I find now that there is much bipartisan and apolitical support, general support, for getting serious about making an energy transition. And there are a couple of large bills that are in place right now. The authorization process is underway both in the House and approval in the Senate. And I'm optimistic, quite optimistic, for the first time that we'll have a chance to take our current geothermal budget, R&D budget, which is zero right now in the U.S., and to re-energize it and revitalize it. We have to catch up to the Australians because they're way ahead of us now in many ways. And I think it's important that I appreciate that. But my journey also takes me here, and I've learned a tremendous amount as part of this assessment study. And I'd like to share with you some of the results of that. I realize this is a U.S.-centric presentation, so you'll have to bear with me. Our language also has some dissimilarities to it, as you know. But I think in the end you'll see there is a lot of commonality to the whole geothermal area. And this is not just about what country does this first or develops and deploys geothermal to a large extent versus one or another in competition. I think this has potential to really help out a situation in the world that we're going to face as we move forward and see the development of energy demand. So let me try to share with you a few of these things, and we'll see how this presentation works. So the original title of the presentation today was called Universal Geothermal Reservoirs. I'm not sure exactly where that came from, but we are going to stay on the earth for this and not move off the earth for the immediate future. But this is what we're really talking about, which was the title given eventually to this 15-month assessment that we carried out. And interestingly enough, this hadn't been done in the United States for about 30 years. And it gave me and my position at MIT an opportunity to do something to bring other people together. And we put together a panel, an 18-member panel, that was focused on two different goals. The first was to provide a truly comprehensive and independent assessment or evaluation of what we're calling EGS. Started out as hot dry rock. Parts of Australia might be referred to as hot fractured rock. But what this is not a separate entity in the geothermal domain. It's a transition strategy to take us from the high-grade systems that we have today to the very lower-grade systems that we might find in the parts of many parts of countries where the geothermal gradients are lower and you have to drill deeper, and other attributes aren't present as they might be in a good hydrothermal system. The other part, and this was the part we never imagined would have the impact that it seems to be having, is to really inform the policy makers in the United States as to what it would take to take the current level of support, which is pretty easy to define, as zero, being zeroed out by the Office of Management and Budget. And if you wanted to make a difference, if you really wanted to see an impact of geothermal, let's say in half a century, and this is not just about tomorrow or next year's funding, it's about a multi-year commitment. That's what we were hoping would be a result of this. So the next part was to assemble this panel, and I'm not going to go through the qualifications of this group, but this represented not only a lot of different disciplines, but a tremendous amount of experience over this 30-year odd period or so that we've been working on EGS. And there were a lot of new people that came in that initially were quite skeptical and that didn't have the advocacy position on geothermal that some of us have. And it was the dynamic of this and watching this process go on for 15 months was an education to me in itself. And what I'm hoping to do is to highlight just a few of the key results that we found and to encourage you, if you haven't had a chance to read this report, to take a look at it. We've tried to write it in a range of forms ranging from a 60-page summary that has a front-end synopsis that almost anyone can understand and of just a few pages to the full documentation, a 400-page report, and there are other appendices available, and I'll be happy to get into that if we want to in the discussion, to show that this is not just a sort of a once through overpass at a very high level. It had a lot of detailed work, a lot of new work that went on. Some of it in particular was associated with assessment of the resource base in the U.S., but a lot of it was concerned with dealing with the status of technology, both for drilling, reservoir stimulation, surface plants and conversion technology to the economic aspects of this and how it might fit into an overall strategy for the country. Now, what was behind this, at least in the U.S. right now, is the vulnerability of our U.S. electricity supply system. Now, this is a set of curves that were put together by the agency, the part of our Department of Energy that is focused on predicting the future and statistically representing the past, but it was what was available to us at the beginning of the study. And so if you take this vertical bar, everything to the right is the future and everything to the left is the past, so this is all speculation to a certain degree. And notice the natural gas line for generating potential here for electricity and coal. Natural gas could never grow to this level of producing primary electricity without importing a lot of natural gas. If you were to go to the EIA website today, you would see a much different picture. One that shows a change in derivative of nuclear where it's slightly positive now. This is only a 20-year period. coal going up perhaps even a little faster, but gas being relatively flat, very slow, much slowed growth, and renewables playing a bigger role. How will those renewables actually be put together in a portfolio, particularly when you're talking about, and remember, the U.S. has a few more folks than Australia, about 300 million. We just passed that threshold last year. In addition, we also passed the threshold of having now 1 terawatt of electrical generating capacity. And if you want to count the number of windmills you might need for this, that would be one way to do it. But I think it's going to be clear that this cannot be just a singular solution. A good portion of the U.S. capacity is in coal right now. We have 100-plus nuclear plants that are getting older and older. So there are many, many reasons why we should be concerned. And here's a summary of a few of them. So the state of the U.S. energy supply system, in the next 15 to 20 years, we have 40,000 megawatts of sort of old coal-fired plants that are capacity that are operating that don't meet today's emission standards. This has nothing to do with carbon. It has more to do with particulates and NOx and sulfur. So something's going to have to be done about that, or they'll have to change the regulations. And in addition, we have this aging fleet of nuclear reactors. And certainly within the next 25 years, some 40% of our nuclear capacity, 40,000 megawatts, 40 gigawatts, will be beyond what we would consider even the most generous relicensing procedures. We haven't built a new nuclear power plant in 30 years. The availability and limitation prices, and increasing prices for natural gas, I've mentioned that, so that has to be dealt with. There still is a lot of public resistance to expanding nuclear power in the U.S., although now there seem to be orders and increased interest, I think partly driven by the fact that we have to get more carbon-free as a future, and nuclear would have a role in that. But also just a change, I think, in the public attitude about trade-offs between nuclear versus coal. And if we're going to go to new clean coal, no matter how we define this clean coal, if carbon sequestration is part of this, these are going to be incredibly expensive plants, and they don't represent a permanent solution, for sure. They represent a transition to how we might evolve to a more permanent solution. And all of this, particularly in our country, where putting in power lines and other energy corridors is is a big deal, will require that. And where this fits into the funding and support is a question of importance. So let's talk about geothermal for a moment here. Is this, in fact, a missed opportunity for the United States? We are producing the largest amount of geothermal-generated electricity in the world, but not much growth has occurred in recent times. We're roughly at 300 megawatts capacity, 3,000 megawatts capacity now. But the plan is, and the strategy of behind this assessment, was could we grow to 100,000 megawatts by 2050? If that did occur, geothermal would all of a sudden have the same presence in the United States as our nuclear reactor part. It would have the same presence as all the hydro in the U.S., including primary hydro as well as pumped hydro, and that would make it a real player, and that was what we thought would be a reasonable backdrop. So when we look at geothermal across the country, this is just one example of considering the near-surface geothermal gradient. We could look at heat flow. We could look at identified reservoirs. We have to recognize immediately that we have a range of grades, just like any other mineral that we might be dealing with. There are going to be extremely high-grade regions. Those primarily, as many of you know, are associated in the western part of the U.S. There are four or five western states that have been the active players, California with the lead, but Nevada and Utah and others developing their geothermal resources. But what about the rest of the country? Last week I was in Texas as part of this journey I've been on, speaking to the oil and gas community about the use of low-grade geothermally heated water that's co-produced during the production of oil and gas. And this represents not necessarily a massive thermal resource in the long term, but in the short term would have immediate impacts, particularly in this Midwestern, if you will, corridor, where you have a lot of hot water and has to be dealt with both in environmental terms as well as to utilize some of the heat. So that too is placed in this continuum, if you will. When we talk about enhanced geothermal systems, there are many cartoons we can draw, and all of them sort of give the same message, that what we're trying to do here is to engineer systems in a manner that they can emulate what nature has provided in these rather few instances around the world. So we're talking about the need to increase connectivity and permeability, porosity, however you might want to define it, to add water if it doesn't exist in place in the reservoir, and to manage that water in terms of recirculation. And in places where we have to go deep, we'll have to develop the technology to do it. And in places where we don't have to be so deep, we'll take advantage of the economic gains of that. And so again, to get back to this continuum idea, when if you look through our report, you'll see that we're really talking about not only today's hydrothermal systems, but also the bigger stored amount of thermal energy that's in conduction-dominated EGS, particularly in deep crystalline rock, but as well as in deep sedimentary basins. The co-produced fluids example that I just mentioned, associated with oil and gas production, and geopressured, which are located in the Gulf Coast region, where we have natural gas, high pressure, and relatively high temperatures, all simultaneously, that presents some interesting challenges to the reservoir management side as well as to the energy conversion side. And again, and this is produced, one of our groups that was heavily involved with this study is Dave Blackwell and his group at SMU, Maria Richards, and we were glad to have them because a lot of the data that is in this report is new, has not been considered. The U.S. Geologic Survey, which is the agency responsible for resource assessment in the geothermal area, has not published a report on geothermal since 1979. So it's time they got started again, and Blackwell's team is helping that along quite a bit. These are three examples of different rock temperature slices into the lower 48 states where we can look shallow, and there's some features on here that you should think about. This little purplish dot up here is Yellowstone National Park. We're not advocating going to Yellowstone National Park, but on the other hand, it gives you a good index of a good geothermal system. And as we begin to go from 3.5 to 6.5 kilometers, you can see that the west is beginning to look a lot more like Yellowstone. And if we can go to 10 kilometers, which is what you would expect to do in sort of a long-term scenario, going from high to low grade, and the whole country, in a sense, is at temperatures, particularly the whole eastern part of the country, where you could generate electricity efficiently, certainly have a lot of heat for heating, direct heating needs, but the whole west is a giant Yellowstone, just somewhat deeper. This is another map that Blackwell's group has put together that it shows slightly different color scheme, but the same kind of idea. And this is at 6 kilometers, which is much more the kind of depth that we're developing EGS today. This is the range of depths that we're thinking about that it projects forward from where you are now at Cooper Basin, where we have in the Soltz project over in France, as a European Union-funded project. The deepest wells at Fenton Hill in New Mexico went to depths approaching that. So it is technically a viable range to consider for maybe the next generation of EGS. And look at these temperatures. Anytime we get above 150 C and upwards, we have usable temperatures for generating power. This is interesting, this thing. Awful sorry. All right, so as part of this assessment, taking these horizontal slices, we can create a histogram of how much stored thermal energy. And this is the, if you will, the secret and perhaps some of the misunderstanding that comes into geothermal. We're not talking about utilizing the steady-state heat flow that comes to the surface by normal processes. We're talking about mining, if you will, mining the heat that's stored down there as stored thermal energy. And there's a significant amount of it. This scale is in exajoules, so this is 1 million exajoules. The U.S. alone, as a country, uses 100 exajoules. That's 100 times 10 to the 18th joules per annum in all of its primary energy. And the similar unit is a so-called quad, so you can think of an exajoule or quad as being roughly equivalent. And so when we sum all those bars up, you come up with this red bar, which is the stored thermal energy in place over the depth range from 3 to 10 kilometers, what is technically accessible and sort of accepted as the USGS resource base for the country. And from that level, you come up with 14 million exajoules. Keep in mind that down here, a 1 on this vertical scale is 10,000 times the annual U.S. energy use. So when you talk about geothermal as a sustainable resource, this is what I think provides a lot of strength to that argument. It's not about the local mining of a small bunch of reservoirs. It's about the sustainability of a long-term strategy which goes after the stored thermal energy in the earth. So these blue bars represent different levels of optimism, if you will, as to how much ultimately could be extracted and utilized, subject to whatever economic and technical constraints you could come up with. So even at a long-term sort of 2% conservative level, only to 10 kilometers and having a long period of time, centuries to develop this, there's plenty of capacity to lead to a very positive picture for geothermal, essentially for the foreseeable future. The idea of this is that if you go after stored thermal energy, you will never be in a situation where you have insufficient energy in place to produce a primary energy, whether electricity or heat, forever. And I think that situation is true here in South Australia. I think it will be true generally for the country as you begin to expand your database for geothermal. Now, again, to do some to fairness here, that as you look retrospectively, as we tried to do in this project, at the beginning of the project, the assessment project, Australia was starting to get very heavily involved in smaller projects. That's occurred in a great way here now, and I'm certainly happy to see that kind of growth. But the one major project that we examined in detail was the Cooper Basin project, because it was active, it was doing real reservoir testing at depth, and attempting to expand the horizon, if you will, of EGS to this very different stress regime. So we went backwards in time. The main blue boxes on here are the large projects. Of course, in addition to this, we had to deal with the Basel situation, which had some interesting induced seismicity. Just this past week, we were fully briefed on that situation, which tells you how important it is to deal with the public when you're developing EGS. But also these other experiments in Japan at the Rosmanalis site and the Cornish Granite in southwest England and at Fenton Hill tell a similar story with respect to the reservoir itself. And we use this as a way to kind of frame the arguments around what is technically known, what has to be done. The critical challenge technically is unquestionably in this yellow box here, that you've got to engineer the system. And engineering it has different aspects depending on what nature has given you at a given site. But connectivity here between a set of injection wells and production wells has to be achieved. What we're looking at is a microseismic map, two-dimensional projection of three-dimensional microseismic signals generated during hydraulic pressurization of the Solst Reservoir in France. And you can see that this is an area where fluid's getting out there. It's causing a lot of fracture reopening and a lot of seismic noise. But it's not well connected to these other wells. And that's not going to probably be a good production system. So how we achieve that connectivity may require a variety of engineering tools and techniques that have to be applied. And it's the demonstration of this that has got to go forward. So what we've summarized in the report, based on these large experiments and a whole set of smaller ones, is a list of things we think we know how to do. Certainly we can do directional drilling to 5+ kilometers. There's many, many techniques that are out there for understanding, characterizing these systems, looking at thermal hydraulic behavior, et cetera. We can routinely now make extremely large systems that are active, active in the sense that they accept fluid, they can circulate fluid, and this is the size we have to be talking about in the range of a cubic kilometer or greater to sustain the productivity and to help offset the capital investment that's got to be made in these systems. We have injection production well connectivity, but it needs to be at a higher rate. And manageable and controllable water loss is a key part, obviously, to the geothermal story in regions where that's important. manageable induced seismic effects and subsidence effects, another important environmental attribute, and we can achieve net heat extraction, the parasitics being accounted for and still get a significant amount. But there's a lot of things left to do. Not a lot of things, but a few critical things, if you will. We have to be able to demonstrate commercial levels of fluid production for sustained periods. And we want to be able to establish one of the beautiful features of geothermal is its modularity, that we can go from megawatt-size installations to 100-megawatt-size installations and to group those together to produce the equivalent of large baseload central station power in the order of 1,000 or more megawatts, such as we have at the Geyser site in California. So modularity and repeatability of the technology over a range of U.S. sites was viewed as us as a key to this, and lower development costs for low-grade geothermal systems ultimately. Not initially, start out at high grade like you would in any mineral extraction approach and work your way towards a lower grade. The analysis that we showed, and this is where the economists, resource economists, and other people that looked at this in our panel very carefully, was that you can do this with a rather modest investment in research, development, demonstration, and deployment in the near term. And there's a big chapter in the report that has many, many graphs in it, and I'm trying to summarize this in one so we can let you all eat here soon. This is the break-even price of electricity that we calculate, levelized cost in U.S. Numbers, cents per kilowatt hour. So that's shown by the blue curve as projected for EGS. And this is a capacity scenario growth showing in the green line out to 100,000 megawatts in 50 years. This is what we were asked to do. And the red line are the projected prices for electricity, commodity electricity. Clearly, this is speculation as well, but I don't think there's anyone that thinks this is going to go down, and there will be lots of interruptions here that may drive that red line even further vertically. But the point is that in a short period, a relatively short period, of say from now up to a period of 10 to 15 years, you reach a point where EGS could compete in the full competitive electricity market in the United States. And another aspect of this, you've got carbon-free electricity. We tried to show by this graph, this does not appear in the report, but I'll be happy to share it with you or leave it behind, as to what different levels of EGS deployment would do to our carbon footprint. And these are gigatons. This is billions of metric tons of CO2 per year. And this is what we have right now, the current production due to electricity production, stationary sources, not automobiles. And this is the reduction levels that we would achieve by different parts of EGS. Unfortunately, as we grow bigger, and we hope we don't go up this curve too far, this is the constant growth scenario to 2100. I think that would make an extremely poor example internationally of us, and it's more likely we're going to see some growth. But that EGS and geothermal could be a big player in the carbon reduction domain. So let's just summarize things very quickly. This is a big resource. It's well distributed, and this is true everywhere, not just necessarily in the U.S. We've got this 14 million exajoules of stored thermal energy. The key point, I said this once, extractable amount of energy that can be recovered is not limited by the resource itself and its size and availability. This fits in a portfolio of renewables. The organizations that are involved with renewable energy need to combine their alliances, I think, much better. This is what the ACOR organization in the U.S. is trying to do. They've been often competing for resources in the R&D support domain. So you have to look for complementarity. And in EGS and hot dry rock, geothermal complements this. This is base load, continuous power, very different than solar and biomass and wind, of course, which can contribute and should contribute where the grades are high in their appropriate domains. This is an extremely scalable technology with a lot of positive environmental attributes. No carbon, no emissions, very small plant footprints, most of the activities underground. Large-scale wind has challenges in our country in terms of where it's deployed, particularly if it's near populated areas, and they're seeing this in Europe too. But geothermal would not have this particular limitation. The technical feasibility. We're focused now on connectivity in all of the field tests going on around the world and improving that we can have sustained commercial production for the long term. The economic projections are favorable. Certainly you see this in the numbers that have appeared in this report. But I think if you look to other countries, projections forward for Iceland that have had a long history of geothermal development, what's happening in Australia, in other countries such as in Italy, reactivating their interest in geothermal. And the deployment costs, and this is a critical area because you're going to need this in the early years. You're going to need both federal and state participation in a big way along with industry. We have a fairly fragile industry in many ways that will have to take the risk and uncertainty burden to some degree in the capital investments needed to get these field sites going. So if we're going to get on a path to 100,000 megawatts, we have to do it in a way where we have engagement for multiple years in the 10 to 15 year range by the state and federal governments. The supporting research costs are also relatively reasonable. For the EGS portion alone, we're talking about $40 million. Now, when you look at these new bills that are in front of Congress, U.S. Congress right now, these are of the order of $90 to $100 million per year committed as far as they can commit in 5 or 6 years into the future, which is a remarkable shift in strategy over what we've seen in the past. A recognition that this is the kind of resource where you can't just deploy a small amount here and there. You have to get involved with fairly large field experiments. So the recommendations we made, and this is very important, we feel, is the first step. You've got to engage the U.S. Geologic Survey. You've got to get back out there in the field. You have to continue this fine work that Dave Blackwell and his group has done, but you have to get much more site-specific about it and more detailed. And you can't just do one field demonstration anymore. We have a lot of those going on around the world. We did it once in Fenton Hill a long time ago. We have to have multiple field demonstrations. That's the only way the investment community, we feel, in the U.S. is going to be brought in accord with the risk and uncertainty reduction. Develop shallower systems in high-grade areas first, along with the co-produced sites that I talked about in Texas and Wyoming and other places. And in the longer term, look towards these deeper resources that will require more costly wells and some more advanced technology at depths greater than 6 kilometer. Put the federal and state policies in place that will incentivize this and maintain a vigorous R&D effort, which has not been true in the U.S., in both subsurface science, drilling, and energy conversion and systems analysis. And when you're all done with this, you come up with an investment of, say, $300 to $400 million total spread over 15 years. And I think most of you know this. This is less than the price of one single commercial-sized clean coal plant. And certainly within the management range, the financial management range of the U.S. Department of Energy and the Congress today. So I'd like to thank you. Please read our report, and I'll be happy to take some questions now or later.